Going?
Yeah.
Okay, yes. Thank you for all dragging yourselves in at this early hour of the morning. I've been asked to talk about intermediate mass black holes and dynamics. And as I indicate here, I will be focusing on of order 100 solar masses because this workshop is focusing on LIGO more than, say, LISA or other hypothetical future devices. And since I suspect that many of you are going to want to have sort of the final answer first, I'll put that up in a little box on the side, and then we can work towards it eventually. So what I'm going to write here is we're going to have rates. And this is going to be in per cubic megaparsec per year. And I'll give you I'll describe a few scenarios, which we'll eventually get to in more detail, and I'll give you minimum and maximum rates, just so we can use this again as a bit of a reference. So I'll talk about cases in which you basically form intermediate mass black holes from individual stars, no fanciness, they somehow find a companion. Cases in which you have a globular cluster, in other words, an old dense stellar system, and cases in which you have maybe currently forming young massive clusters.
Sorry, Colin.
I'll define all these things much more later.
Yeah, I have just a basic question.
Yes.
So when you talk about the intermediate mass black holes, and then other people talk about stellar mass black holes.
Yes. I'll define what I mean.
Mass black holes, one can have 100 solar mass.
I will define what I mean.
What is the difference? Is there a difference?
I'll define it in a second.
Okay.
I'll just put up my box here, and then we'll make some definitions. So for maximum rates, if we're talking about 100 solar masses to 100, we're talking about
100 to what?
So these are so for the scenario of having it just form from single stars, which is, as you were saying, Alessandra, not sort of the standard part of the we're special intermediate mass black hole definition, but again, I'll get to it. We're talking about 10 to the minus 5. This is a huge overestimate of the actual rate, probably, but it's a maximum. It's useful to at least write that down. For globular clusters, for this, it'd be maybe a few times 10 to the minus 10. And for young massive clusters, maybe a few times 10 to the minus 9. Again, I will get to all of the assumptions and whatever that we need for these. Now, if we have instead something like 100 with a 10 solar mass, again, if this is about 10 to the minus 5, this is a few times 10 to the minus 9, and this is a few times 10 to the minus 8. So these are the maximum rates. For the minimum rates, again, we have 100 and 100 and 110. And for this, this morning, I actually went through quite a few calculations. I think the numbers I'm going to put up here for the minimum are accurate. And we'll get to that later, too. Okay, so this is going to be sort of our reference table. We can think about as we go through some of the different processes. All right, so like you were saying, Alessandra, we will begin with some definitions. So what is an intermediate mass black hole? Well, when I have worked on these objects, I have tended to have the following definition. If the mass is, say, between 10 to 2 and 10 to the 5 solar masses, it is not in a galactic center, and not formed from an individual star in the current universe. In other words, ongoing. This is what I've usually defined it as. And the reason is that we want to think about special circumstances that can produce extra massive black holes. However, in honor of Chris, I'm going to eliminate this requirement. And part of the reason for this is that although indeed people are starting to think about much more, because people are now thinking about much more massive stellar mass black holes that can form from individual stellar collapse, this is something that I think is going to lead to some interesting new possibilities for 100 solar mass black holes and possibly even larger. But there's still a lot of dispute about this. And again, to sort of give you a bit of a hint about where I'm going to be going here, one of the reasons that this definition has often been thought to already implicitly imply that it's not forming from individual stars is that when people talk about the maximum mass of a stellar mass black hole formed in today's universe, and indeed the maximum mass of its precursor, zero age main sequence star, they have perhaps been overly limited. So they're talking about, you know, absolute limits of 150 solar masses, which is going to blow off almost all of its mass and produce maybe a 20 solar mass black hole. But this may not be accurate, so we'll open up our minds a little bit about that. Now, why do we care about these particular types of masses in the sense that we'd like to know more about the universe? And from the GR standpoint, all black holes are the same ho-hum yawn. And so what mass it has is irrelevant. But of course, from the standpoint of astrophysical context, this is not true at all. The astrophysical context in which you might be able to form a several hundred solar mass black hole is quite different from the astrophysical context in which you're going to form a 10 solar mass black hole. So there are a few ways you can think that these would be very interesting, particularly when coupled with gravitational waves. So why do we care? So one reason is that, and I'll write it like this. There is no direct dynamical evidence for black holes between 50 and maybe 10 to the 5 solar masses in the universe. There is direct dynamical evidence for black holes lower and higher. It's dynamical evidence that's the critical thing here. If you think about why is it that we're so confident that stellar mass black holes exist? Well, the basic answer is that in a number of cases, actually a very small number compared to the number of such black holes that exist, we can see these objects in binary systems, and we can do measurements of the companion. And in some cases, we can get extra information like the probable mass of the companion or a limit on it and the inclination of the orbit, which actually tells us the mass. We're pretty confident in Kepler's law, so we're sure that this is a good mass. And these masses, depending on whether you want to have just a lower limit to the mass or an estimate of the mass, are ranging somewhere between maybe 5 and possibly as high as 35 solar masses. When it comes to supermassive black holes in the centers of galaxies, the direct dynamical evidence, the lowest mass that people have ever seen where they have dynamical evidence, again, seeing stars, either actual full orbits as in our galaxy, or far more commonly, you look at the redshifts or blue shifts compared to the galaxy of the stars, we might be down to a couple million solar masses and up to a larger and larger value that is now approaching 2 or possibly 3 times 10 to the 10 solar masses. But there's this big gap in the middle. Why is this?
Well, isn't there, I thought there were claims of kind of 1,000 or 10,000 solar mass black holes from the same argument, statistical orbits of stars.
Yes. Those are, interestingly enough, much more disputed. So there are a couple of examples of globular clusters in our local group. one in M15 as an example, and one in G1, which is the largest globular cluster in the local group. It's around Andromeda, where, as you say, people have done precisely the same thing. They have essentially said, look, we have looked at the motions of stars, and we see that there is evidence for some dark mass in there. Here's the critical distinction. In the case of a binary, in the stellar mass black hole, you know there's only one dark thing there. There can't possibly be multiple because it's going to be dynamically unstable. In the case of something like our galaxy's black hole, you can make similar statements. You can confine that extra dark mass into such a small region that there's no plausible alternative. There are plenty of implausible alternatives, and we probably have them write to us every now and then, the people who prefer those implausible alternatives. But for serious people, no. If you're thinking about the dynamical cases of M15, Omega Centauri, G1, the problem is that you are not at that level. What you can say pretty definitively is that there is a fairly high mass-to-light ratio in the centers of these clusters. What is not as obvious is whether you can demand that this is in one object.
What is the mass they're inferring at once?
So depending on who you talk to, M15, 1,000 solar masses, G1, 20,000 solar masses, Omega Centauri, 40,000 solar masses. But the problem is that in most cases, you can't confine it to a small enough region. You could, for example, absolutely rule out a collection of white dwarfs or neutron stars or stellar mass black holes, all of which would give you a high mass to light ratio. So if you want to be really, really strict in your definition, it's only the stellar mass and the supermassive black holes where we have direct dynamical evidence that they exist.
But then, just to take that kind of, I'll take a contrarian view, then really the only place where we know that a supermassive black hole definitively exists in this argument is the Milky Way, right? Can we really make that argument for external galaxies where we don't measure the scale of the, right? I mean, we just, so by association.
Yes, there are. So you can do it with Andromeda as well. And there's actually some interesting work that has been done on this. And it depends a little bit, of course, on how pathological you want to be. So even in the Milky Way, it is impossible to rule out that some mischievous, very powerful alien race with a weird sense of what to do with their time has packed in 4.4 million solar masses of dark matter of the elementary particle type. You can't rule that out recently. So the way that you do this is you say, look, in the Milky Way, in Andromeda, possibly in M87, if you were to have that much mass in individual stellar mass objects, the relaxation time would be sufficient that it would have dispersed in much, much less than the age of the galaxy. So it can't be a persistent structure. But yes, for by far the majority of the tens of objects where people say they have dynamical evidence, you can't be nearly as strong as you can in those cases. So it's a small number, but good enough.
So I remember in grad school the idea of whether the Milky Way center was a black hole or a collection of something like white dwarfs was the big argument. You had many debates on this. And so it really has only been in the last 20 years that even that's been, people have said yes. People decided they gave up fighting the battle of.
That's right. Of course, when you were in grad school back in the last millennium, people did not have the kind of.
Being recorded, buddy.
Well, it is a
fact. So there were, as you know, quite a few observational developments which were key, one of which was actually starting to see accelerations of the stars in the center.
Yeah.
There were actually times in the late 80s, there was an excited announcement of a 10 to the 11 solar mass black hole in another galaxy. They actually turned out to be merging galaxies, so the motion was not orbital. But yeah, the Milky Way, it's good to be this close to the Milky Way, probably for many reasons, but one of which is we get to see a black hole close up and personal. Okay, so all that being said, for intermediate mass black holes, we do not have systems in which we have this kind of definitive dynamical information. We would if there were a case where there were an intermediate mass black hole with a companion and it was maybe sucking matter off the companion, and we could do the sorts of studies that have been done for stellar mass black hole binary systems, getting a mass function, possibly even inclination somehow. The problem is that objects of these masses are rare. So whereas we have more than 20 cases in our galaxy of stellar mass black holes in binaries where you can do all the measurements and figure out at least mass lower limits and often good values for the masses, they're much rarer for intermediate mass black holes. Things like ultraluminous X-ray sources, which are candidates for IMBHs, are far away. The nearest ones are megaparsecs away, 2-3 megaparsecs at minimum. So the companions, even if they are massive stars, or bright stars, which they probably are dim. So this is the difficulty. Now, you know, you say problem, I say opportunity. So this is one of the cases in which if gravitational wave observations reveal that in any system at all there is a 100 solar mass black hole, this is going to be definitive evidence that they exist at all. And right now, this is disputed. So I tend to be on the level of, I think these do exist, and I think there is good circumstantial evidence, which I'm happy to discuss if you wish, but you're not going to win a Kip-like bet until you're getting dynamical evidence of one type or another, and gravitational waves are an example of that. Now, what other things would interest us if we could show that, in fact, IMBHs exist? Well, as I will discuss in some of these possible scenarios, they might tell us about the actual initial mass function of stars. So if it turns out that there is a path where, remember, I have crossed out my standard requirement that these can't be formed now. So let's say we're thinking merely about black holes in this mass range, not in the centers of galaxies. Maybe you can form these from individual stars, in which case this tells us that there are ways to form very massive stars now, which tells us also about things like wind. So a common complaint has been that if you have a very massive star, it will basically blow off so much of itself that it can't even get to a high mass to begin with, let alone survive as a massive black hole. Also, things like dynamics, which coincidentally is a word here. So it tells us possibly about sites where you might be able to form intermediate mass black holes. Also, from the gravitational wave standpoint, these are systems where, depending on what they might be merging with, generating gravitational waves, would possibly give us something that Ilya has also worked on substantially, intermediate mass ratio in spirals. So cases where you don't have comparable masses, cases where you don't have an extreme mass ratio. So this can give people excuses to work on different types of perturbation theory. So these are...
We have mass ratio much smaller than 1/10.
It could. So for example, if you had a neutron star going into 100 solar mass black holes, so about 100 to 1.
Mm-hmm. So you're focusing the rates more...
In the rates, I'm focusing on ones that are 1 to 1 to 10 to 1, which is in the range that people have already explored numerically.
But is it because this one has much lower rates, or what?
Yes, so you just can't see the ones with neutron stars as far, and that's going to make a difference.
Is it just low observational rates or low rates at which they occur at all?
So if you're talking about a field star, so something that would just form somewhere in a galaxy, it's going to have essentially one chance to merge with anything. And so in that case, the actual rate per volume per time is determined by however those systems are produced. And there's no special reason to think that it is any less than the rate at which it might merge with comparable mass objects or 10 solar mass black holes. In fact, it's probably more. But it's going to be a weaker event.
But okay, so if you're forming it in binaries, if it's an IMF and you're forming it in binaries, the thing that seems to be fitting and also fitting the data, granted this is for 20 solar mass stars, is that the mass ratio is distribution is flat.
Yep.
So if you say it's 10 to the minus 1, only 1% would have, if you say it's 100 to 1, only 1% of the stars would have 100 to 1 difference in their mass ratio. I mean, I realize
but remember,
it's 10 to 1 for those, yeah.
So it's true, but remember that the stars that make neutron stars are not 100%
more like 10 to 1, yeah.
Yeah. So if that works, and we have no special evidence that it does, there would be fewer neutron star ion behavior. Yes, it's true. But I think that this is a field where there's so much uncertainty in a lot of things, we'll just try to keep an open mind. So it could be that it's a higher rate, it could be a lower rate, tough to say.
Yeah, okay.
So these are reasons why these are objects of interest. They're going to give you kind of special properties when you're looking at the gravitational waves for them, and it'll tell you a lot about astrophysics as well. Now,
so Cole, one question. I know you defined. I stepped in a bit late, so I missed that.
No problem.
But you defined the non-galactic center.
Yes.
But let's say that there are 10 to the 4 solar mass black holes in centers of galaxies, and they can disrupt, white dwarfs or maybe main sequence stars. I'm not sure if that works, but
They can destroy anything lower density than a white dwarf can.
Yeah, and so would that rate be substantially higher?
10 to the 4,
the mass of the electron. Yeah, so let's say that it's a low mass version of the black hole in the galactic center, the Milky Way galactic center. You know, some galaxy at 10 to 4, 10 to 5.
Yeah.
That's one goal. Would that rate, and that might produce some electromagnetic, not necessarily a gravitational wave signal, but an electromagnetic signal. Do we expect that rate to be higher, actually? It may be easier to detect that.
Well, because I think the call is more focusing on advanced black hole vehicle.
No, that's fine.
I understand. I'm just trying to understand the rate, whether the route to discovering the existence of these intermediate mass black holes is through gravitational waves or is it better done in another way?
Look, I agree. And I'm, by the way, I think the point of these discussions is to kind of wander to realms of interest. And it'll be sort of disappointing if I actually get through my notes. So, in answer to your question, Ido, this is actually something that people have kind of gone, they've gone back and forth on the dependence of, let's say, tidal disruption and stellar consumption rates on the mass of the central object. Now, it's clear that at the very high mass end, if you have standard two-body stellar relaxation operating, the rates have to drop. So disruption, of course, doesn't happen after 10 to the 8 solar masses, but even the rate at which the stars are getting there has to drop because it just takes such a very long time to relax. When you get to lower mass systems, then there also has to be some point at which the rate is less than optimal because the stars wander around rather than setting up a dense cusp, which can actually go in. So as far as what's in the middle, what's the peak? Is it 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6? There were some early efforts to determine this that suggested that you could maybe even build up most of a 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole by consumption of stars. But those rates might have been a bit high. So I do indeed think that this is something which is promising. Now, in terms of devouring white dwarfs, there you would expect the rates of such events would be lower, probably because they aren't that much heavier than main sequence stars, so they can't really segregate too easily, and the majority of stars wouldn't have evolved into white dwarfs, but maybe not by enormous factors of 10 or something like that. So I think this is one of the very exciting aspects of the transient universe in general, and all these different observational approaches to it. So we shall see. People have in fact speculated that this might be one of the best ways of establishing that you have those masses. Because as you know, the dynamical influence of a 10 to the 4 solar mass black hole on its immediate galactic center environment is not that substantial. So saying, yeah, we know it's there because of dynamics, you typically have to use line widths and stuff, and there are problems with that. But for what it's worth, since you mentioned this, let me say why I'm ruling out the ones in galactic centers. The basic reason is that there doesn't necessarily have to be any kind of special formation mechanism. There's a lot of just cold gas that pours down. So over 10 billion years, some lucky 10 solar mass black hole that happened to be very close to the center of the galaxy could just swallow a bunch of gas. So it's not something that has any of the potentially required dynamics or interesting star formation scenarios that would be required for things not in galactic centers. Okay, any other thoughts before I talk a little bit about the scenario that you form these in the field? So, as part of just a stellar formation ordinary type.
Maybe I'm anticipating something, but
yes.
About the rates you wrote there.
Yes.
The one in field, are they consistent with the one that we heard from Chris Paczynski with low metallicity? Is that?
So they would be, other than the fact that when we did the stuff with Chris, our maximum star we considered was 120 solar masses. So we could only, which would get 100 solar mass, but that was at the top of our, we had an IMF that went up to there and then cut off. So, you know, the reason you can get such a wide answer is we don't know the IMF up there. So we don't know the initial mass function. So we're making fewer and fewer stars up to 120 solar masses, and then we're making zero above 120 solar masses.
Because if you translate that in detection rates for advanced LIGO,
it's enormous.
It's enormous?
Yes.
How many do you get? Hundreds per year?
It's actually ruled out already by initial LIGO not seeing them.
Do you want to guess a realistic number on that?
There is no realistic number. So I'm giving. I will explain where I'm getting my maximum value. My minimum, I think, should be pretty clear. And it's somewhere in between there. But to say what a realistic number is would start putting in whatever my personal prejudices are. And at least in this field, those prejudices kind of shift on a daily basis.
So it really is a case that what we're going to see in advanced LIGO is actually going to help you.
That's right. So I'll make a general point, which I plan to make in any case. When you think about the observations that you do, there's always the question of, is detection interesting? Of course. Detection's always interesting of anything. Is non-detection interesting? That's a tougher question. So if you do a dark matter experiment and find a null result, that's fine because there's an infinite space of lower and lower cross-sections you can appeal to. So it'd be great if you see it, and if you don't see it, you can rule out parameters in models and maybe some specific models, but not the whole thing. And when it comes to something like LIGO observations, you can ask the same sort of questions. When in S1, the stochastic group determined that omega in gravitational waves is less than 23, we kind of knew that already. But now, it's at a situation where it's actually below the BBN limit. So it's a better limit than we had before, and yet it's not something that is yet really approaching anywhere where reasonable inflationary models would suggest. So it is in the realm of we're ruling out space we couldn't have ruled out before, but we're still not at the stage where it's likely to be a realistic background level. So what about in these cases? Well, here I would say that we know so little about the exact circumstances in which you're going to form an IMBH that if you can address anything between those two limits, it is at least telling us something interesting. If you get lower and lower values, it's not going to cause stellar evolutionary people to jump off bridges in despair because we simply don't know enough. So it's not at the level where we absolutely expect something, and if we don't see it, we learn a tremendous amount. So it's kind of in that medium. So let's talk first about the issue with the IMF. And I'll give you my numbers and how I get 10 to the minus 5. But let me first say, and this is something which I learned from Chris recently, what people used to think is the following. They say, look, we know that massive stars have winds. And the more massive, the more substantial the winds. Reasonable enough, the luminosity asymptotes to the Eddington luminosity, and that's going to do some violence to the matter. So you blow off a lot of mass. Indeed, the argument would go, at some point you can't even continue piling matter on. So in the formation of the star, the assembly, at some point the star says, enough, I don't want any more, I'm done. Not only that, but during the evolution of the star, it is also blowing out an enormous amount of mass, even on the main sequence, but certainly when it gets over to the giant stages, it's throwing off huge amounts of mass. And therefore, went the argument, we don't think that in the current universe, when there are a lot of heavier elements which can provide good opacity sources, we don't think it's possible to produce a black hole of 100 solar masses. from a single star. And therefore, there was a lot of discussion about the early stages, the population 3 stars, when nothing substantial beyond helium had been formed, because then you have a very limited set of opacities. And the winds aren't as substantial. You can pile on more matter to begin with. And when the star evolves, it loses a lot less mass. So you end up possibly with very massive stars. Very, you know, cool stuff, right? Not just 100 solar masses, but in realms where you can have these pair production supernovae, in the realms even beyond that where you have direct collapse to anything above 260 solar masses. Yeah, cool stuff, maybe true.
What's the main physics that goes in? Is it the opacity that you're talking about?
Yeah.
That's the only thing?
So that, well, okay, so there are two things that are important. The opacity is a big issue, so is cooling.
Yes.
So people were talking about the early stages when you had only hydrogen and helium, and it's a question of what is the mass of gas which can finally collapse. So the genes mass, after all cooling has operated. And there is where you're also suggesting that without the heavier elements around to provide extra cooling channels, you're not going to be able to get down to the lower masses. But then, once the star is assembling, because you know it's not really a situation where there's an isolated gas blob that forms a star, there's a lot of infall and complicated things going on. It's able to prevent itself from growing larger, maybe because of the radiation driving, and then lose mass during its life. So those are the two main things.
So beyond the genes argument, but a little bit in the sense of cooling.
Yeah, in fact, this is also something. Astrophysics is rich with unsolved problems, and one of those is exactly what it is that determines the mass scale of stars. For one thing, of course, there really isn't a very well-defined mass scale for stars. There's a nice power law extending over quite a few factors of mass. But in terms of this, if you think about the genes mass, people, if you work on the early universe, it turns out to be about constant at somewhere around 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 solar masses, which is very exciting, but there aren't stars like that because there's a lot of cooling and fragmentation that happens. If you do this in our environment of the galaxy, also the genes mass is way, way higher than the current masses of stars. So it's clear that you can't just make the simple one-line argument about what the mass is. In terms of what the masses are, the cooling and fragmentation is probably bound up in some sort of turbulence, which gives you natural power law scales, and that's acceptable over a wide range of masses. But this is being discussed very actively because it seems that cluster star formation is a crucial component of this. Again, it's not that a chunk of gas becomes a star. It's often competitive accretion. There can be globs of gas that can segregate in the original clusters. So somehow it all comes out with the power law, which is sort of the default for a theorist and possibly also for the universe.
So for these very massive, I thought that the newest simulations on formation of population 3 stars show that there is actually quite a lot of fragmentation, more than was suspected initially, and they don't end up as
that. Indeed. In fact, we have a former graduate student, Volker Brahm, named Athena Stacey, is now at Goddard, very near where I am at Maryland. And she presented this result, and indeed, they had much greater fragmentation and much smaller masses. So it almost seems like, gosh, we're back to there's no change at all. The IMF is the same everywhere. But what I do worry about is that those simulations have not been run long enough to determine if there's reaccretion going on.
If everything essentially ends up merging.
Yeah.
So there's one other effect, and that is, so pop 3 stars, the problem is you still get cooling through molecular hydrogen, but there must be a name, but I call them pop 3 prime. Once you form these stars, they emit photons that prevent molecular hydrogen formation, and then you can get to another regime where you don't have as much fragmentation because you've removed molecular hydrogen cooling.
Yeah.
So there is even, it turns out it's a much more rich field than the pop 3 people thought.
It's true, and to give another indication of how rich these can be, if the primordial fraction of deuterium were 10 times larger than it is, so not a huge factor, and if it happens to be larger in some particular place, HD cooling makes a gigantic difference to how small you can get to the mass, because H2 gets you down to about 500 Kelvin, but HD is not homopolar, so it can have dipole transitions and is heavier, and so it gets you down to 100 Kelvin. And since the gene's mass goes like T to the 3/2, it's a factor of 10. So all of this stuff has to be considered, and I think we're a long way from being absolutely sure about how it all works.
But I'm going to reiterate your comment about the subsequent accretion is an important, so for these most massive objects, the subsequent accretion is really the deciding factor on where you go. So
can I just ask one final question?
Well, ask a question, and if other people want to add in, sure.
If this is the case that, there's a lot of fragmentation that's going on, you really can't form very heavy stars, even the top three, then the only scenario left for black hole seeds is small black holes, 100 solar masses at best.
Oh,
which keep on accreting matter many, many generations over to become what they are now.
By seeds, you mean the supermassive black holes?
Yes.
There, as you know, is a lot of discussion about different ways of doing this. Mitch Bagelman has been pushing the idea of quasi stars, that in some circumstances you can have a million solar masses accumulate and not really be a star per se, but be something that can collapse directly into a black hole for a short time. And there are other suggestions as well. So we've worked on the possibility of runaway mergers in early dense stellar clusters. Yeah, it has to happen somehow. And as quasars of higher and higher redshift are...
Runaway mergers in the sense that there's something that is formed and then you merge a lot of these things together.
Yeah.
In the form of gas. All I'm asking is, do they grow by accreting gas or accreting stars and black holes?
So in our particular scenario, the runaway mergers are black holes with black holes in special circumstances. The advantage being that you can avoid the Eddington limit, which is the big problem that you have if you're trying to accrete gas.
Sorry.
If you think, and this is not a guarantee, but if you think your mass accretion rate is limited by Eddington, then going from square one to Z of 7 and managing to come up with a 10 to the 9 solar mass black hole is a challenge and a half. So people have tried to avoid this in a variety of ways. Either you start heavy, or you can violate Eddington in one way or another, and there are various proposals for how this is possible. So given that we have all these uncertainties, if we're going to try to have a broadly agreed upon upper limit, we probably shouldn't push too hard on any specific mechanisms. So I'm just going to be very simple here. I'm going to say that the initial mass function is saltpeter, by which I mean that dn dm, so the number in some mass interval, is proportional to mass, it's usually 2.35, but if you believe we actually know this to two decimal places, I have a bridge to sell you. And this is for mass, let's say, greater than 0.2 solar masses. And the reason that this is a limit is that when people have actually done surveys of these, and you should probably understand that these are not easy to see, but when you look, you find that it's not that it just goes power law indefinitely. In fact, at even lower limits, there's a deficit of brown dwarfs compared to what you'd have here. But let's basically say you're starting at 0.2 solar masses, and you're going up indefinitely with this power law. It converges at the high end, so you can probably sleep all right at night knowing the universe isn't infinitely massive. If you were to then say what fraction of these are above a certain mass, then it's just one more power of mass. So fraction above mass is proportional to then m over 0.2 solar masses to the minus 1.35. I'm just integrating dn dm. And that tells you that the fraction, which are, let's say, above 200 solar masses, so if we're going to get to 100 solar masses for our black hole, we'll allow some wind driving of some mass, and this also happens to be a nice factor of 0.2. This is about, therefore, 1,000 to the minus 4/3, or 10 to the minus 4. And that would tell us that in the Milky Way, for example, we would have on the order of 10 to the 7 of these that had existed at some point in the history of the Milky Way. Now, that's a lot. These things are not dim. There are a couple of factors that would reduce the number that we would expect to see right now. One is that they don't last very long. If you do the asymptotic limit, so as you probably know, for stars like the Sun, the luminosity scale is something like a mass of 3.5, give or take. But as you get to higher and higher masses, of course, that's going to run into the Eddington limit, which is proportional to the mass, not mass to the 3.5. So this runs into that Eddington limit, and for massive stars, 20 solar masses and above, 50, whatever, they more or less asymptote to a total main sequence lifetime, which is basically their whole lifetime, of somewhere around 2.5 million years. So if we were to ask how many are there now, we would first have to say you have to take that lifetime and then divide it by the age of the galaxy. So if we were to say what is the number now, then we're taking our 10 to the 7.
So what was M now, sorry?
Yeah. Milky Way.
What was the 10 to the 7?
Milky Way.
The number in the Milky Way.
Yeah, so the total number in the Milky Way. If
is
10
mass larger than 200 solar masses?
Yeah.
Well, so if 10 to the minus 4 of stars have more than 200 solar masses, and the Milky Way has about 10 to the 11 stars.
Okay.
So this would be the total number in the history of the Milky Way. But the number that we would see now as stars, first of all, we take that 10 to the 7 and we multiply it by on the order of, we'll round to be 10 to the 6 years divided by 10 to the 10 years. And so this would be 1,000. Except we also know that in the star formation history of the universe, we're not actually forming stars very actively now in the universe in general. And if you look at a redshift of, say, 1 or so, it would be about 10 times what it is now. So if we then multiply by, call it 0.1, say the star formation rate in the Milky Way is 1/10 of what it sort of has averaged, then we're talking about on the order of 100. But this is still pretty large. Again, these are really, really bright. We're talking about 100 solar mass things that are radiating at roughly the Eddington luminosity. And therefore, we're talking about things that are, you know, a couple times 10 to the 40 ergs per second. It's not like you'd miss these very easily. Interestingly enough, however, there actually is evidence that things of this mass do exist. In the Milky Way, more so in the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is something that is per mass much more actively forming stars. There's one particular knot of stars called R136. And as a side comment, you know, back in the old days, we gave things proper names, you know, Aldebaran, Sirius, Capella, whatever. But I guess at some point we run out, and so they became things like R136. So they're And so there is evidence. In that case, the authors have claimed that not only is there a single current 265 solar mass star, but a few others that are above 150 solar masses. But it seems likely that there aren't 100 of these, so we already might be overestimating a little bit. So I don't know what this says in particular. There's probably some evidence that there's a bit, at least a steeper slope, if not necessarily a strong cutoff.
So generally in population census now, and I don't know why, we use the other standard, I can't remember the name, but it's 2.7.
Krupa?
Is that Krupa? Yeah. So the 2.7 is what you'll see in most people's population census codes if they do one calculation.
Okay.
And then you can see that's already going to decrease the number by
factor 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an extra third, so it's a
third times a thousand, yeah. So it's even maybe
factor 10, exactly.
Oh, yeah, exactly 10.
Yeah. So if we're talking about something steeper, so alpha equals 2.7, not 2.35. And so, by the way, is this a rollover, or is it something where this is also, it's 2.7 and 1 solar mass?
It's a rollover around.
Yeah. Okay, so in that case, it about works.
So the 0.1, I forgot, you reduced it by a further factor of 10.
So the thing that you would do here, so
that's
10 to the 7, 2.35, would be sort of our standard number. This is a lifetime issue.
That's fine, but you had a 0.1 here.
The 0.1 is because since it's such a short lifetime, what we're really doing is we're basing this on the star formation rate right now. And the star formation rate right now in the universe in general, in the Milky Way as well, is less than it was historically as an average. So we're saying that it's a tenth of the average rate.
So if you ask what was the star formation rate for the last million years, it's much lower, and these guys were the last.
Yeah.
Cole, alternatively, I mean, you could just say that, okay, let's say 3.5 solar masses per year is star formation rate today, you know, to wait or picking a reasonable number and do the calculation just based on that, right? I mean, so you know, intent of this, since you only have things that were formed in the last 10 million years, you can say, okay, there were 3.5 million solar masses worth of performed, okay, out of 3.5 million solar masses, what fraction of the volume do things above 200 solar masses, same exact calculation?
But then at redshift of 1, we have to go back to 1,000, is that what you're saying? Whenever it peaks.
Yes. Yeah. So the point is that although the current stars above this mass, maybe there are 10 in our galaxy, then we're talking instead about 10 times that many of their remnants. Oh, actually, sorry, more than 10 times. So we're talking about maybe instead of 10 to the 7, well, okay, it depends on the numbers we're talking about here. There might be 10 to the 7 total remnants in the galaxy, most of which are not stars. They would be the black holes. And so this 10 to the 7 would go to 10 to the 6 if we use Chris's 2.7 number. Now, one cautionary comment here, and I also talked to Bill Paxton and to Chris about this yesterday, there is actually kind of a history over decades of people thinking that they have seen really, really, really massive stars. And actually, it turns out that they weren't single, very massive stars. They were a cluster of massive stars. And I want to mention why this is, because it actually is going to turn out to be relevant later when I talk about dynamics. So it's a question of identification. So, first of all, why am I going into this? We need observational indications that you might possibly have stars that could conceivably evolve and become 100 solar mass black holes. If there's no evidence of such a thing, if there's a radical cutoff above 100 or 120 solar masses, the odds are much, much less. So why do we think we're going to be able to identify a very massive star? Well, your first thought is obviously that you do it by colors. That's the simplest thing to measure. And this is how you can figure out whether you have a solar type star or an M dwarf or an F star or things like this. The problem, however, is that for masses above about, call it 20 solar masses, the photospheric temperature is constant, independent of mass. And this is therefore an indication that the colors are the same, so you cannot tell the difference between, let's say, a single 200 solar mass star or 450 solar mass stars. It makes a big difference in terms of what they can evolve into. Now, why is this? It turns out that if you think about the opacities that are determining the size of the envelope, because it has to achieve some balance, there is a very strong uptick due to iron at temperatures a little bit above the 50,000 degrees Kelvin that is this limit. So essentially, if you had a star of some mass and it was trying to contract, then it would go up in temperature and the opacity would go way up and therefore it would be puffed back out by the radiation. And that's the reason, because there's a strong increase in opacity, that the temperatures are about constant. This is the thing that has bedeviled people when they have attempted to say, yes, I think I see a 200 solar mass star, or whatever it is. Oops, gosh, it turns out it was several stars that are less massive. In the particular Crowther et al. Paper, which looked at R136 and picked out several objects that they thought were individual objects above 150 solar masses, one at 265, they therefore had to use another argument. And the argument they used, interestingly enough, was dynamical. When you have excellent enough angular resolution, maybe you can't tell the difference between a star and a pair of stars. But what you can say is that if there are a pair of stars or multiple stars that are there, that there are dynamical interactions in the dense stellar environment of something like R136 would cause that system to have a very short lifetime. So probabilistically, it is unlikely that these are multiple stars. No?
How short? I mean, since the lifetimes are short anyway, they're a million years.
I forget the exact number. It was well under 10 to the 5 years, if I remember correctly. So it's not something where you'd have to have a 1 in a million chance of seeing it. So maybe it's a few percent or on that order. But it's still short enough, and there are several such objects, that the odds are decent that they're not, at least not all, multiple systems.
So that was the main reason they disregarded the possibility that the system was composed of different stars?
That's at least the part that I read, yeah.
How close are these objects? Where are they at?
It's in the Large Magellanic Cloud.
Okay,
Large Magellanic. 50 kiloparsecs.
Because this argument would follow, as they go further out, it's going to be harder to do this, right?
Oh, sure, yeah. If you've got something a megaparsec away, you couldn't make
you
these
couldn't
arguments.
Do this diet.
All the time scales and everything would be the distance scales you could resolve would be too large for you to make these statements.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then this is about as good as it's going to get, then?
Yes. So at least this is, or if there happened to be some kind of knot in the Milky Way itself, you'd be able to do this. But per mass, the Milky Way is forming stars far less actively than Large Magellanic Cloud. There have been some arguments some people have made that when you get very active star formation per mass, it is more likely to have cluster-type star formation, which might lead to greater probability of heavy stars.
This is the stars begetting other stars? You know, is this the fact that you can form bigger stars maybe with the radiation from other stars or the supernova from the other stars?
Or direct collisions.
Okay, or direct collisions. Okay.
Yeah. So those sorts of, those ways of producing stars may be more likely if your star formation rate is higher. It doesn't seem definitive one way or the other.
So can I ask a critical question? Because you can mention at some point, yesterday, the day before, something about a 400 solar mass star, not just a 260 solar mass star. So I was wondering where.
So the object there, the R136, the stellar modelers would tell you it had to be formed at 400 to be.
It was 400. Okay, got it. So yeah, okay.
The massive, I guess the stars are Wolf-Rayet stars. They're not on the main sequence. And so you somehow have to reconstruct their history.
Okay.
And ask what was
your
initial mass.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
So now let's talk about our rates. If you've got these stars in the field, which I sort of define as in a low enough number density environment that they have no dynamical interactions, at least after they have formed black holes, then they have one chance, which is a merger with a companion. That's it. There are no other possibilities. So in that case, what this means is that the absolute maximum rate you could ever get would be one merger per 100 solar mass black hole in its lifetime. Now, depending on the numbers you want to have here, so let's stick with these for the moment. What this tells you is that the maximum rate is 10 to the 7 per Milky Way divided by 10 to the 10 years times the usual density of the Milky Way equivalent galaxies. This is a rate that is independent of the nature of the companion. It's a maximum, upper limit. Way, way over enthusiastic, but this is the best you can do. So in other words, pick your favorite companion. Is it a 100 solar mass object? Is it a 10 solar mass object? Is it a neutron star? Is it a, an M dwarf? The best you can ever do is make all companions of 100 solar mass black holes that and have them all merge. So that's not going to happen, of course. In fact, there are a lot of things in between that can be seriously problematic, and I guess that Chris Belchinsky talked to you about black hole, and common envelope phases and all these other things we don't understand. But at least this is, I think, a strong upper limit.
But, with all this uncertainty, do you care about specifying 100, 100, 100, 110?
Oh, because the rates are different for here and here.
Oh, okay. So in this so for fields, you don't really see any difference?
No. You'll have at most one merger with something. Now this rate, however, is incredibly high, and with a stress on the word incredibly. And that rate has, in fact, already been ruled out by initial LIGO non-detection. But why do I put this up at all? And the reason is there is a lot of room for there to be constraints on these sorts of mechanisms. Since the maximum possible rate is orders and orders of magnitude above what advanced LIGO could theoretically detect, this tells you that you at least are going to be able to eat into these scenarios very substantially.
So I have a question about whether or not you could already, with existing, forget about LIGO for a moment, with existing electromagnetic observations, very significantly reduce this rate. So for example, if you were going to, you know, can you, for example, use the limit in the number of ULXs to say that the rates? I'm sorry,
ULXs. Also, limited
sorry. I apologize.
We have a little flag in series. We use acronym flag.
Okay, you're right. So can we? Okay, you know, can we? So somehow, you know, this you know, I completely agree with this is sort of the maximum plausible number, but I'm just wondering whether we can make it a little bit more realistic by using other arguments.
So one way you can think about this is what are you likely to be able to see right now? So let's say that, again, since we're being very, very generous here, we'll take the shallower slope and say there are 100 per Milky Way equivalent galaxy. And of those 100, you could ask what fraction of those are currently accreting. Actually, you know what? Sorry, I'd better be careful.
That's the companion star.
So if you have 10 to the 7 in a given Milky Way galaxy, what fraction of them would be accreting now? You know, it's actually going to be an even smaller number. So how long is it that a 100 solar mass object is going to be able to accrete a one solar mass companion?
But we're not talking about one solar mass companion. We're talking about, I mean, you're putting in the limit on 100 plus 100 systems.
That's an even shorter time.
Yeah, so that if you increase the mass, the problem is that then it really is this you know, at most, the companion only has that million year lifetime as well. And then it's only accreting onto its black hole for even a shorter time. So it could be zero easily, even though I'm forming 1,000 black holes, black hole binaries, could be zero at any one time. Right now, could be accreting.
Yeah. So
maybe the question should be differently. If you're going to have, I see. So you're suggesting is that somehow you're starting all of these binaries that are eventually 100 plus 100 solar mass black holes wide enough that there is no interaction until they both happily form black holes, and then they merge 10 billion years later.
So it's hard to calculate the rate of binaries from X-ray binaries that we see, normal X-ray binaries, simply because we don't know the duty cycle of the X-ray emitting phase of X-ray binaries.
That being said, I think that there are, you could, with some model dependence, put in extra limits. If you think about the number of ULXs per Milky Way equivalent galaxy in the universe, I forget what it is now. It's like 1 per 100 or something like that, maybe even a bit less. So if you're thinking about having, say, potentially 10 or 100 at these maximum rates active at any given time per galaxy, then this is going to reduce your rates. I wonder, though, whether you'd even do better by the current lack of detection by initial LIGO.
So what's the lack of detection give us for, can we do that quickly?
So
what was its range?
It should be about 10 to the minus 7.
A few times 10 to the minus 7?
I think it should be a few times 10 to the minus 7 in this match range. I can tell you.
Can we get megaparsec?
I'm sorry, no, but I mean, we actually have the numbers and units of, you know, per megaparsec per year that are published, so it's more. I believe it's a few times 10 to the minus 7, but let me check.
For a 100 and a 10?
No, 100 and 100.
100 and 100, okay.
So, Colin, there's something I'm puzzled about with this number, then, because it's only with a factor of 10 of the square footage.
S5 per search.
But if I go back there, the number of 10 solar mass stars relative to 200 solar mass stars is more than a factor of 10, right? What am I missing? There's
part of it may be the difference.
It's as high, so you could...
No, but I'm taking this at face value, right?
Yeah, so what he's done is he's... And so if I use a, I did this at some point, I used a -2.35 and asked how many systems are forming above 20 solar masses? How many stars are above 20 solar masses? I remember it being roughly 40% of all supernova if I use a 2.35.
Okay.
And so if it goes to, 10% as you go up, that would be well with your numbers. If you use instead 2.7, the number goes down by, like we said, a factor of 10, so it can go...
Yeah, so I'm saying that number is not consistent. That power law with that number, with the observed supernova rate,
it's why we usually use the 2.7.
Okay.
But even that is not enough. So even then, LIGO is saying it even has to be at order of magnitude lower, although population synthesis probably would put it down at that. So that, I think the upper end of population synthesis calculation where they put in all the rates would be at 10 to the -7 as well, but with reasonable numbers, but this 10 to the -5 is definitely a safe upper limit.
Yeah.
I mean, he was making sure that no population synthesis would ever get higher than that rate.
Yep. Right, so in terms of the how far we could see this with advanced LIGO, I guess, according to Ilya, one would be able to see the 100 to a volume that would be about 10 to the 10 cubic megaparsecs. Is that right, Ilya?
Yes, I think with the full version of advanced LIGO, it may actually be even a little bit larger.
Okay. What do you mean by full version?
So there are these discussions that I'm sure Duncan had and so on, that you have sort of early advanced LIGO, intermediate advanced LIGO and so on, right? That it doesn't sort of, they're on the full sensitivity at once, right? So full version, I mean,
our public thing, right? Advanced LIGO is one, which is the only thing that you probably know.
No.
Sorry, how did I use this number?
Did you include the measuring down or not?
Yes, I included the measuring down and I included redshift regression, so that should be basically in units of co-moving volume rather than...
That sounds right. It gives you 1 gigaparsec. I think it may be a little bit more than
one redshift.
I would say
the maximum distance you can see is for these things is actually pretty high. It's getting close to redshift 1.
Yeah.
But remember that we have sort of this weird peanut shape and so on.
Okay.
Yeah, I would have thought that it's a factor of 10 or.
Well, be careful about co-moving volume versus non-distance volume. It actually begins to play a very big role. That gives the order of effect of 10 when you're talking about these kinds of predictions.
So, but is it reasonable to say that all things considered, co-moving volume, it's about 10 to the 10 for double 100 and about 10 to the 9 for 110?
I believe so. Let me check just in case what actually wrote in my email.
Okay. Well, if somebody comes up with a better number, we can put it up here. But this okay. More or less tells you what advanced, this is for LIGO first. It more or less tells you, actually for all of these scenarios, what advanced LIGO is or is not going to be able to do. So
one very interruption, the upper limit, the published upper limit for initial LIGO for the S5 run in the 100-100 bucket is it's 1.5, right, it's 1.5 tenths to the -7.
Okay.
or okay, depending on which bucket exactly you're looking at, it's 1.5 or 1.9, but whatever. But it's basically less than 2% of the minus alpha upper limit.
All right. So in other words, that has already dropped this by at least a factor of 100, but has yet to address the other issues.
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. Thanks. Any other thoughts about sort of formation from individual stars before I start discussing a bit about globulars and dynamics? Okay. So let's now go from the scenario in which you essentially have a single star evolving, maybe with a companion, which is where we get these stunning rates, and that's mainly because there are a lot of stars out there, to the possibility that in dense stellar environments like globular clusters, maybe nuclear star clusters, or currently forming young massive clusters, which are of course ultimately incorporated into the body of stars into the galaxy, and so it wouldn't be seen now individually. What are the prospects of having these sorts of merger rates? And before I go into the dynamics itself and what would happen in such clusters, I want to again just give you sort of the overall numbers and how it is that you can get these sort of maximum rates even without any thought about specific dynamics.
Could you actually say a bit about the difference between globular clusters and young massive clusters?
Okay, so globular clusters are very old stellar systems, and these are old stellar systems which tend to have a halo population. So they don't follow, if it's around, say, a spiral galaxy, they don't follow a disk. They are distributed more or less isotropically around the center of a galaxy. And they are thought to have formed maybe 12 billion years ago. Young massive clusters, well, the young is obviously a key here. This is something that you can get if you have, let's say, a collision between galaxies which are gas rich. So you can have lots of shocking and very high rates of star formation. If, for example, you look at M82, which is a fairly nearby small but actively star-forming galaxy, it has hundreds of these young massive clusters. In terms of masses of the objects, so for globulars, you know, typically 10 to the 5 solar masses, and it can range between maybe 10 to the 3 and 10 to the 7. And for the young massive clusters, it's somewhat similar.
So they mostly arise from collisions of galaxies, or is it sort of natural for a galaxy to have these pockets of really dense activity through Oort's null?
It looks like there needs to be. So if you have a very active star formation, you tend to see these more often. And I don't know exactly what the current state is, but a lot of people think it is certainly true that if you have collisions, this is one way of inducing a lot of star formation. There may be other ways as well, but with supernova shocks or things like this. But
I think in the local universe, it's essentially an emergent system.
Yeah.
So these are different than like the SIGOB association. That's not, is that a young cluster or is it not?
Well, we're thinking about things that are big.
Okay. So the nuclear clusters belong to the same category?
Or? So nuclear star clusters, there's been a fair amount discovered about these recently. So our galaxy has a nuclear star cluster, so a fairly dense stellar region in the center. Yeah. It also happens to have a supermassive black hole, which turns out to do things to the dynamics which are not tremendously favorable for also producing an intermediate mass black hole. In smaller galaxies, there is at least the current prospect that you may have nuclear star clusters without a central supermassive black hole. And there, maybe you can run off and get your 100 solar mass black holes from that, from dynamical processes. If you think about the total mass in stars, they're actually decently comparable to each other. We have about 100 globulars around our Milky Way, total mass about 10 to the 7 solar masses, which is of the order of what you have in the center of our galaxy. So it may be at least similar numbers, more or less. So you don't necessarily have to treat them separately. They give you similar values. And actually, for this purpose, the globulars dominate. So, all right, so globular clusters. So again, we're not going to do dynamics yet. We're just going to talk about numbers and get those numbers. And then we'll talk about the actual possibility of forming intermediate mass black holes in them and what you might learn. So globulars, since, as we know, all galaxies are like our Milky Way, there are about 100 globulars. And the number density of these things, of Milky Ways, is 0.01 per cubic megaparsec. And the product is 1 per cubic megaparsec. Now, okay, that's a little bit flippant. It actually turns out that elliptical galaxies have a specific frequency of globular clusters, so number of globular clusters per stellar mass in the galaxy, which is 10 times or so times that of spirals. So if you actually count things up, this might actually go to more like 3 per cubic megaparsec. But if you look at my table and you look at the logarithmic range between the minimum and maximum, a factor of 3 is really not all that substantial. So we're talking about a few per cubic megaparsec in the universe, more or less. And since these are old systems, this is more or less what it would have been any time between now and Z of 1 or 2. So it's not like there's been a huge set of globular formation, probably in most cases, since Z of 1, although if you want to be specific about it, there are some cases where you think there's been more recent formation than others, but never mind. All right, so globular clusters. So 3 per cubic megaparsec. So now let's imagine that we have a 100 solar mass black hole that has somehow formed in this system. We'll get to this somehow in a bit, but right now we have wished for this on Christmas and we wake up to find that it is so. So in this particular case, we have this 100 solar mass object, and we ask, how often can this 100 solar mass object merge with another 100 solar mass object? That's where we're going to be talking about this rate here. Well, the answer is at most 1 time per globular cluster. Now, why is this? The basic reason this will turn out to be dynamical is that if you had a lot of 100 solar mass objects that had somehow formed in this globular cluster, they would have thrown each other out before they got close enough to merge. So it really is the case that you're likely to only have the last couple merge together. And indeed, it's actually not all that easy to see how you're going to form many of these things in one cluster. So I don't want to be absolutist about it. It may possibly be that in a few cases, you can have more than one such merger, but it seems very unlikely. So this is going to be the 100 with 100 is going to be at most, so less than or equal to 1 per globular.
If you form a 100 solar mass black hole somewhere in the globular cluster, how long does it take it to sink to the center?
It's very rapid. That's one of the numbers I'll get to.
That's the reason why you're saying they will fly out.
Exactly. Not only will they get to the center and find each other quite rapidly, but if there are many of them, there will be a bloodbath, and most of them.
Then if I can form them, sequentially,
over 10 to the planet. So this is something which is an interesting new look on globular clusters that people had. Back in the last millennium when I was a graduate student along with Chris, the wisdom was that for globulars, there was one and only one episode of star formation. It all happened 12 billion years ago, and that everything has kind of evolved dynamically since then, but there were no new stars formed. But this is something that has gradually been eaten away, and there are people who don't believe this as much anymore. There are some specific cases like Omega Centauri, where there's specific evidence, observational evidence of multiple star populations in there. But Omega Centauri, biggest globular in our Milky Way system, has often been considered a bit of a weirdo. Maybe it's the core of a dwarf galaxy that merged with the Milky Way, so maybe it shouldn't count. But more and more now, people are looking at globulars, ordinary, self-respecting globulars, and saying, we actually think there is evidence for multiple stellar populations having formed. If that happens, then your number goes from 1 to 2, merger. Or 3, if you have 3 very distinct episodes of formation that each produce a pair of hundreds. So to our level here, it's not a huge difference, but it is good to think about, I agree. On the other hand, suppose that you have 100s with 10 solar masses. And so here, this is an argument due to Ilya. Now, in principle, depending on the nature of the system or who knows what, it could be that you have a very large number of these. Maybe stellar mass black holes are produced aplenty, and somehow in your system you had 100 of these produced, and you managed to make them all merge with your 100. So the actual number could be big, maybe, if you want to be open-minded. That's not going to do advanced LIGO any good, though, because once it has doubled its mass, or maybe a little bit more, it drops out of the frequency range of advanced LIGO. Now, you can play games with this. One of the games you could imagine playing is that, at least in a few cases, if you have a very rapidly rotating 100 solar mass, or what it becomes, black hole, then the frequencies can be a little higher. And so even with higher masses, you can start seeing these. But there are a couple of unfortunate aspects about rapid spin. So one is that it's unlikely. You're going to have things coming in all different directions. There's no disk of stars or disk of gas that is going to tell each new merger that it has to be in this direction. As a result, it means that the spin parameter, all else being equal, is going to drop with time. The other problem is that, in fact, so the argument would be less than or equal to 10 per Slavik cluster, because once it more than doubles its mass, you can't see it anymore. But even that's unlikely.
But I don't understand this argument double its masses. I mean, the noise, if you plot, where do you get the reach for advanced LIGO, it's actually peaks around the redshift in mass around 400 solar masses.
400, so you have an ESCO frequency of 10 hertz?
It's a little less than that.
I don't know which one. He's also using the
So you can make that 40, right?
Okay, we change it to 30 or 40, absolutely. I mean, this was an approximate scaling. And by the way, I should say,
I don't understand, where does it come, why from 1 you go to 30?
Why from 30?
If he just accretes 30 10 solar mass black holes, he's now made a 400 solar mass black hole.
Yeah. So one here is because there's only going to be one other this massive that can possibly survive to merge. Here, it's a matter that you go out of the advanced LIGO frequency bin. And if 400 is your value, then 30 10 solar masses plus the original 100 gives you 400 solar masses. OK?
Not really, but it's okay.
Well, why not? Okay, so you want to make it 500 and make it 50, right?
I'm not understanding the argument.
The argument is there's no physical mechanism to form it, so let's just assume that they merge, and then the black hole keeps getting bigger. So the one thing we have a physical constraint on is mass conservation. So the black hole keeps getting bigger, eventually becomes so big it goes out of band.
You merge one tenth solar mass object, you mean it becomes bigger, so you're counting how much it can grow such that it doesn't go outside band.
That's right.
Yes.
Okay. That's right.
And it's also worth pointing out that you could, for example, say, well, okay, but let's imagine they're not 10 solar mass black holes, they're 1.4 solar mass neutron stars, right? Because we're going to be agnostic. And then, of course, you have many more mergers, but you see them less far by, okay, the scaling is roughly comparable to the mass in this case. And so basically, the total detectable merger rate is actually going to end up being comparable within small factors of order unity, whether you assume that the typical inspiraling low mass companion is a 10 solar mass black hole or 1.4 solar mass neutron star. It won't matter given the uncertainties we have here. It'll change things by 50% or something.
Right, but it's actually worse than that. So this is the 10, 30, whatever. This is the very optimistic limit. It's probably a lot less than that. In fact, my guess is that really it's probably less than, say, a few, deliberately being vague. Why? Because of gravitational wave recoil kicks. An issue with globular clusters is that these have very shallow potentials, gravitational potentials. If you take a rich globular cluster, not ridiculously, but kind of on the rich end, it has an escape speed of about 50 kilometers per second. And a lot have less than that. And so if you're talking about actual mergers with 10 solar masses, so 10 to 1 type of mass ratio.
Is larger than 50?
When you have spins, yeah.
Oh, when you have speed.
Right. So here, this is where you get the great uncertainty about the formation mechanisms of IMBHs. So if there's some reason that you're confident that IMBHs form with very low spin parameters, then this is not a problem. In fact, for non-spinning objects, exactly non-spinning, the kick speed is always less than 50 kilometers a second for this mass ratio. So it's not an issue. But if you're thinking about things that have a distribution of spins, then the usual thing is you're going to get kicks that are hundreds of kilometers per second, even at this mass ratio.
What do you expect this number?
So this is using the RIT formula, the thing that the most recent they put out. And if you're talking about having, say, a distribution of A over M between 0 and 1 and isotropic kicks and all that, even at this mass ratio, it's going to be well over 50 kilometers per second most of the time. And even if it isn't initially, then the initial merger between two non-spinning objects will give it some spin. So, you know, you can do a calculation with some set of assumptions, but unless you're very lucky, it doesn't seem particularly probable that globbers will be able to hold in the results of these mergers past at most a few mergers. So this is my guess. But we'll still put however many, 30 if you wish, as the upper limit. Now this is something that is going to immediately allow you to get the maximum numbers that I was talking about. So if we're talking about a lifetime of these globulars of 10 to the 10 years, which is usual, then if we are talking about a few per cubic megaparsec and one of these 100 mergers in the lifetime, and that already gives you a few times 10 to the minus 10 per cubic megaparsec per year. So that's the way I got that number.
Do they have to be in a core collapse state, or it doesn't matter?
For the typical globular cluster, you mean if you have the two 100s? It doesn't matter. No. The relaxation time for objects that massive in a globular is so short, it just bam. This also, by the way, means that globulars, in the standard sense of having had one star formation episode 12 billion years ago, are not great options for watching the gravitational waves from these types of mergers, because it'll happen very, very fast. So to tolerance, it's essentially the redshift of formation of the globular. Not exactly, but you know, watch a few hundred million years delay between friends. So this means that most of those are going to happen early. Now, what about these? Well, same thing, actually. But in this case, maybe you have 10 or 30 per, so we've upped the rate by a factor of 10 or 30. So I think that as far as globulars go, and as far as mergers with things like 10 solar masses and above, these are not great options for current observation of gravitational waves. When you get to lower mass objects, let's say you've got neutron stars, you've got white dwarfs or puffy, so that wouldn't count for gravitational waves, but for neutron stars, that's a very different story. Because not only can you have 100 of them, or a few hundred of them, before the object becomes massive enough to go out of band, but they're not going to cause the thing to get kicked out of the cluster at that mass ratio. So there is where at least your upper limit, most optimistic scenario is something that could give you rates which you might be okay for detection or limiting. But in terms of the specific scenario, it turns out to be tougher to have that many objects fall into the black hole. Now, I'll do the young massive clusters here because it's essentially the same general arguments. So the young massive clusters. So let's say that you're forming these clusters more or less when there is a major merger between galaxies, usually defined as mass ratios of, you know, one to a few, where a few depends on exactly how you want to do the threshold, between 1 to 1 and 1 to 4, or 1 to 10, something like that. You have lots of gas maybe, and you slam them together and you form tons of stars, and lots of those happen to be in massive star clusters. Well, if we look at M82 and it has a few hundred of these things, let's say that 1,000 is the typical number. Again, we're doing upper limits. So maybe this is going to be 1,000 per Milky Way equivalent galaxy per merger. So the question would then be, how often do galaxies run into each other? And this is something which is not trivial to determine, but what literature I've read suggests that Milky Way-ish galaxies have maybe tens of percent of them have had major mergers since Z of 1. And it's typically not more than one. Is that reasonable, would you say?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's take a few tens of percent, make it 100%, since we're getting an upper limit. And so that essentially means that we therefore have a total per galaxy since Z of 1 of about 10 to the 3 young massive clusters. And that's 10 times what we had here. So we upped the numbers by a factor of a few, or 10 or something like that. So that's why I got the numbers on the right.
What's the total mass of a typical globular cluster?
10 to the 5 solar masses. So if you really wanted to push things, and I'm not sure that even with the upper limit philosophy I'm willing to do this, if you really wanted to push things and argue that most stars are formed in clusters of some sort, then you could get numbers that are even higher than this. But I think that's too much.
But then, is the idea that the 100 solar mass black hole came from the IMF, or?
In this case, here's where it kind of blurs. Because their clustered, or at least associated, star formation appears to be the rule in the universe. So it's not easy to say what would happen if you somehow separated all stars from each other and asked what masses would they form. What I mean is that it may be that a lot of the power law and a lot of the very most massive stars require clusters in order to get to that mass.
No, but I'm thinking specifically in the case of globular clusters, if the typical mass is 10 to the 5 solar masses.
Yes.
And with this number, that would suggest that there is essentially 0 to 200 solar mass stars.
Well, if you have, it suggests you have one, right?
Yeah.
Well, or less, right? Because it's 10 to minus 4, is it by,
so
it's by number.
This is by number. So if you have 10, so this is the fraction by number that are above a certain mass. So with this flatter value, it'd be 10 to the minus 4, with 2.7 be 10 to the minus 5, so it's 1 per cluster.
My reason I was even thinking about it is actually more for the 10 solar mass black holes. To get 30 of them, you're actually, you know, I would have thought that when you get these 10 solar mass black holes, a lot of them are just getting kicked out before they merge. So you're saying you have an efficiency, a good efficiency, of every time a 10 solar mass black hole gets in there, it actually merges instead of being.
It's one of the reasons this is a maximum.
Yeah. I mean, so there's lots of ways to look at these and say, oh, the number will go down because of this or that. You are putting in this maximum that almost any effect we include will lower the rate.
That's what a maximum is.
Yes, they know.
I mean, it's probably useful to restate this. The philosophy behind the numbers in that table and a lot of the discussion here is to establish what is a number everyone can agree is a maximum. It can't be beyond that. And then determine, is it interesting? What can be measured with advanced LIGO? Is it interestingly enough lower than the maximum possible value that you actually have some space to constrain some things? There's no doubt that there are a lot of ways in which you could have numbers far less than this. So these are the raw numbers. Any thoughts about this before I start talking more about the dynamics? We should have asked some questions.
The mass of the global cluster 10 to 5, that would be like a current mass, is it right?
And could it have been higher when it was formed?
Yeah, it could be. Like today's mass could be like just 3% of what it was formed with.
Yeah, that's an exciting possibility. So if you wanted to, but I think you're still not likely to have more than 100 solar mass object around.
Well, if you increase the mass by 2 orders of magnitude, instead of 1, you would have 100.
Maybe not. So this is probably a useful question to address when it comes to the dynamics.
Because people did those studies and tried to estimate how the global clusters lose mass as they evolve, and I believe that they were losing about 90% or more of it.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, most of the mergers, if they exist, would still be early on.
So what? No, that's true, but you wanted to put the highest numbers on the blackboard, so I was wondering why you're not using 10 to 7, let's say, instead of 10 to 5.
Well, I'm not. I'm not actually using the globular cluster mass as part of this estimate. So we have the number density of globular clusters, whatever that is. And then I'm saying that I expect only one double 100 merger per globular at most, because I think that the rest would kick each other out.
So merge with each other. Yeah.
Maybe. But fair enough. So maybe there's reason to be slightly more optimistic about numbers. But well,
the point that the time scales are short and the formation is early is, and the volume that we can go out to is roughly range of one.
Is a problem
because then those rates essentially go back to zero.
Exactly. So this is why I think the young massive clusters of the cluster type are the more promising, because at least they're still forming. And at Z of 1, the star formation rate was pretty substantial, so you might have a better chance at those. And of course, the point is that since these clusters are forming in the disk, then you have a lot of dynamical effects that will eventually incorporate them into the disk. So they don't maintain their clusterhood indefinitely, more or less the way the halo population does, because they're not harassed as much. As they said, some of those are harassed enough to lose a lot of their mass. But OK, so let's talk a little bit about dynamics and what is likely to happen in these dense stellar systems.
So for, let's say, another 20 minutes, because that's really the limit.
OK, so we usually go to 11:30?
Yeah.
That's fine. So in terms of the dynamics, let me give you, a couple of important numbers. There's a concept I'm sure all of you have run into at some point or another called the relaxation time. And the reason that this is relevant is if you have a heavy thing, how long does it take to sink to the center? Because the center's where all the action is. That's where all the high number density is. And to make a statement like, if you have two 100 solar mass black holes in a system, they will find each other, requires that they be able to go to the same spot. The relaxation time, the classical Sulfur relaxation time, the 3 over log lambda, where all logs are 10, and so that's what people usually take here. It's actually fairly close to being true. Log of 100 is about 5, log of 10 to the 9 is 20, so within a factor of 2, it's pretty close to being 10 in both cases. Times whatever the velocity dispersion is, and this would be maybe at some radius in a system, times g squared times the density of the other things it's interacting with, and times the mass of the object in question. And to give you a particular number here, where I'll be using values that are reasonably characteristic of dense-ish globular clusters or young massive star clusters, and for 100 solar masses, this is about 2 times 10 to the 5 years times the velocity dispersion over 10 kilometers per second. So this is decently typical of globulars, times the number density divided by 10 to the 5 per cubic parsec, the minus 1, times the mass over 100 solar masses to the minus 1. So heavier things, denser things, and smaller velocity dispersions, this is cubed, of course, are going to give you smaller relaxation times. So essentially, this is two-body relaxation. So you have two objects that are passed by each other like ships in the night and deflect a little bit. And this can affect the orbital elements. When you think about heavy things tend to sink in gravitational potentials. And there are these lovely thermodynamic analogies that people have put together when it comes to stellar dynamics. And in particular, if you imagine two things orbiting at about the same radius, therefore they can have an interaction, they have about the same speed, but the heavier thing therefore has more energy. So in the attempt to go towards a thermodynamic equilibrium, the heavy thing gives up energy to the light thing, and giving up energy in the gravitational field means sinking. So heavy things tend to sink. When you have something very massive like this, it sinks quite rapidly. I mean, look how absurdly short this is. So this is such a short time that if you somehow make a massive object in one of these systems, it can sink to the center. It turns out that this is also very important for the young massive clusters, because it means that if you have a star that is of this mass, or 50 solar masses or something, it actually has time to dynamically sink to the center of that cluster while everything is a star and before all the supernovae have gone off. So there's actually time in a sufficiently dense cluster to have these heavy objects sink and actually hit each other. So that's an important thing.
So I'm just thinking about supernova kicks during the formation of this 100 solar mass black hole, because the velocity, escape velocity from a globular cluster is a few tens of kilometers per second.
So, yes.
You know, I don't know what's expected. No, we can make anything out for this supernova mechanism for 100 solar mass
black hole. It's an ejecta-driven kick, so it's from the ejecta. A 100 solar mass star doesn't have huge ejecta masses. So we think it just, if it were non-rotating, it would just collapse into a black hole.
I see what you're saying.
So, it would,
so if it's formed by direct collapse, then it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, now I think there's still a lot of discussion about exactly what produces the kicks, but yes, there is, for example, an issue of why it is that you have as many neutron stars as you apparently do in some clusters. So in things like 47 Tuck, there's evidence for 100 or 200 neutron stars, mainly as quiescent X-ray sources, so not absolutely definitive. And those, you know, at least many neutron stars have kick speeds of hundreds of kilometers per second, so ongoing discussion. Part of the ongoing discussion, I guess, has been sort of undone by recent understanding of electron capture supernovae, per Chris. Chris the first, not Chris the second.
I would argue then, it can be an iron core skeleton.
All right, fair enough. So there are different things people talk about, but for these masses, maybe it's not a big deal. Another issue to point out here is binaries. I'll sort of speed up the dynamics here. Why? Well, when we're talking about these mergers, so far we haven't really discussed how you're getting a merger between two 100 solar mass objects or two ten, or 100 and a 10. It just sort of happens thus far. But the thing to realize is that even for objects of 100 solar masses, the cross-section for two of them, unbound, not knowing each other, just smacking into each other, is very, very low. Indeed, even the cross-section for them capturing, so coming close enough to each other that they radiate enough gravitational radiation to become bound, in which case they would spiral together soon, even that is a low cross-section. So it turns out that there's a mediating influence of binaries and, indeed, three-body interactions with other stars that is very important. So you have your binary, and you have some other object that happens to be coming in. The question is, what's going to happen? There have been a lot of numerical simulations of this, actually starting in the early 1960s. And these are chaotic interactions in the formal mathematical sense. They're chaotic. But you can get statistical tendencies. And among those statistical tendencies are that if the energy of the entire system is negative, so the binding energy of the binary is greater than the kinetic energy of the interloper, it tends to be that the net result is the binary at the end is more bound than it was. Another tendency is that the net result of all of this is likely to be that the two most massive of the three objects are in the final binary. It's not always the case, but it happens often enough that this is something, and people understand this again in terms of various thermodynamic analogies. Now, the reason this is important is, suppose that you have formed your massive object. Maybe it's 100, maybe it's something else. Even if it's solitary to begin with, it's really, really likely to end up in a binary. Because there are enough binaries in clusters of all sorts. And the fraction is processed in maybe several percent to some tens of percent, depending on densities. But there are enough stars out there that are in binaries that they will swap and they will make the massive object part of a binary. So if you think about, say, two 100 solar mass objects, they can start wherever, and when they come together, they will form a binary with each other. And now, since they're really heavy things and nothing else is as heavy as they are, it means that all of these encounters are just going to gradually harden the system, hardening meaning bringing them closer together. they will also change the eccentricity of the system. And this is an interesting discovery that was made by actually my first graduate student, Kayan Gilteken, who is now a postdoc at the University of Michigan. If you think about the eccentricity of these systems, it makes a big difference to how rapidly they are going to merge by gravitational radiation, of course. Given semi-major axis, higher eccentricity means it's going to merge a lot faster. You can think of these three-body interactions as kind of scrambling the eccentricity. But essentially, because if it happens in some interaction to get to a high eccentricity, it'll merge, it means that there's a tendency to merge from a fairly high eccentricity system. Not high enough eccentricity that in LIGO's band you would see eccentricity, it'll circularize by then, but it speeds up the process very substantially. So this is true for 100, 100, 110, and if you take, say, a 100 with a 10, then work that Ilya led that I was on suggests that in these sorts of typical clusters, the total amount of time from the formation of the objects themselves and then making it into a binary to when they would merge by gravitational radiation, you end up with a few times 10 to the 8 years. So this is the number to keep in mind. If you have your 100 solar mass object, it will get in a binary in a fairly short amount of time. And then other massive things, like if it was in a binary with a half solar mass star to begin with, some 10 solar mass object, if they're around, will substitute and come in. Then they're going to come together, they're going to merge within a few times 10 to the 8 years, and then that new single object is going to go hunting for binaries again. So this also tells you that it is not implausible that in the history of these systems, you might be able to get tens of objects processed through in this way, if they haven't all been kicked out.
The question here, you said that object would go hunting for another partner. I doubt that. Probably it would be ejected with such a speed that it would leave the cluster. I think it's more likely.
If it is a 100 solar mass object, and if...
No, 10. I was thinking about 10. 10 solar mass black hole being ejected.
So here's where there is ongoing dynamical work, obviously. And there are, I think the questions are not yet answered. It is certainly true that when people have talked about clusters where the black holes you form are all of the 10 solar mass variety, some dispersion, but no outlier at 100, then those objects tend to segregate towards the center where they have a higher interaction rate with each other. And there have been papers that have suggested that there is a very rapid rate at which they all kick each other out. And after a fairly short amount of time, having started with whatever number it was, maybe 100 to begin with, you end up with, you know, 0, 1, or 2, and the two would merge with each other. But I have been told that some more recent n-body simulations have suggested that you might have more than that left over. So I think it's still...
Who's work was that, do you remember?
I do, but I think it's work that he is pursuing now, and so he probably doesn't want this mentioned.
Okay.
Yes. So this is, however, the number to keep in mind, and this is goes along with this number to indicate that the dynamical processes involving a 100 solar mass object are pretty fast.
But you need that massive one object at least to change those conclusions from other papers. For those 10 solar mass black hole populations.
My anonymous source suggests it may not even be necessary.
It may be that, yes. But it's unpublished that, yes.
Right.
Okay, now I have your picture.
Okay. You do? Wow, that's impressive.
No, I'm following what you're saying.
Oh, okay, yes, very good. So this is, in other words, you get your massive object, it sinks to the center, has lots of interactions, and in principle, it can process these things rapidly. But, as Chris said, it could be that its source of 100 solar mass objects, or sorry, of 10 solar mass objects, has been kicked out long before, in which case it would need to feed on smaller things. By the way, in case it occurred to you, you could have 100 solar mass objects in essentially every globular cluster without knowing it electromagnetically. So the rate at which it would be consuming stars and whatever is not so substantial that you would have expected to see many of these. Now the young massive clusters, and I guess I will end with this. For these, again, you have the same relevant relaxation times. If you think about a cluster that has just formed, we imagine that there is some lightning bolt from Zeus that produces all the stars at once. Now the heavy things can sink to the center. And because massive stars are not points, they can actually hit each other. And because this time scale is short enough, people have proposed in the past that you can end up with a runaway collision. So the condition for a runaway is that the collision rate has to go non-linearly with the mass, meaning that the biggest thing will gain mass at the fastest rate, and therefore it will just run away. And this happens because the cross-section that we're talking about for interactions that are gravitationally focused, one criterion for this is that the orbital speed at the star where you're having the collision has to be much more than the typical speed of the fields of the stars in the cluster, which is easy. Big stars, thousands of kilometer per second escape speeds at surface, 10 kilometer per second typical velocity dispersion. So that happens easily. So this cross-section is proportional to whatever the pericenter distance is, how close you get, times the mass of the object. This is part of the gravitational focusing. But the radius of a star at some mass is proportional to m to the 1/2 for high masses. This is a consequence of the temperature being constant for very high masses. Right? So the luminosity is basically Eddington. The temperature is constant. That tells you the radius has to go like mass to the 1/2. So this means that this goes like m to the 3/2. And so this is nonlinear, and you can have the process of a runaway going on. So people have proposed that if you have a short enough relaxation time, so you need a high enough density, then the heavy stars sink, they hit each other, and having hit each other, they're now even bigger than they were before, and they're more likely to hit other things. There have been simulations done of this where you can, within 2.5 million years, run up to a couple thousand solar masses in some cases. Why is 2.5 million years magical? Because that's when you start having supernovae. And supernovae, because the lifetime of a massive star more or less asymptotes at 2.5 million years, it means that all of the massive stars are going supernova at the same time. So the core loses a lot of mass. And the loss of mass of the core impulsively means that the core expands. The expansion of the core decreases the number density, decreasing the interaction rates, allowing more time for more supernovae. So essentially, this shuts off the runaway. But there has been now some back and forth over the past few years about whether this is actually something that really could lead to such extremely massive stars, and indeed whether those could lead to intermediate mass black holes. The issue here is winds. So winds happen, and with massive stars they happen more, and if they are substantial enough, went the argument, it could be that for, say, a 400 solar mass star produced by this collision process, the wind loss rate is greater than the rate at which it's gaining mass by hitting other stars. And so you could kind of top off at a level that might not be that high. However, according to Chris Fryer, there has been discussion, perhaps backroom discussion for a while, maybe coming into the light now, that the wind rates could have been significantly overestimated in that case. It's tough, of course, because very massive stars are sort of, by definition, very rare. And so it's not as if you have a lot of easily accessible information about this. But I'd say this is therefore in play. This would be a sequence where you would have for the young massive clusters. You run away, you have your collisions, and maybe the wind loss rates aren't huge. And then when the object becomes ready to leave its life as a star, it collapses and produces a black hole. So another comment about this is that, and this is again the frontier aspect of this subject, these collisions, the rates at the end of the simulations that don't include wind loss at least, the rates are ridiculously high, once per few hundred years. And this is absurd. It's so high, in fact, that it's actually significantly shorter than the Kelvin-Helmholtz time of the star, which is the time necessary for it to radiate away energy. And this is the relevant time scale, because if you have a collision, essentially you have jolted the star with a huge amount of extra energy, and it is not in equilibrium. Now, if that star has time to radiate away and settle into whatever equilibrium star exists at that mass, that's fine. But if it doesn't, then it becomes something that Melvin Davis likes to call a bag of cores, where you have all the core remnants of the original stars kind of swimming around in an extended envelope. And it's not really easy to see what's going to happen at that stage. But at least that is something that is a possible way of forming IMBHs. And then, for the reasons that I said, the fact that you do have ongoing star formation, and at least in some fraction of these clusters might have the conditions for a runaway, is still, I think, promising for forming these intermediate mass black holes.
I think something we have not discussed until now is the prediction for more stellar mass black holes with lower masses than 100 in Loveless cluster. We have not discussed this.
I thought there was some discussion on this at the conference, and I think it seems like the consensus was it's a minor perturbation on that.
Oh, not for black holes necessarily. So I guess, I mean, Chris, let's see if you agree with the following.
Not to discuss now. I'm saying, you know, we could have another discussion before you read about it.
May I say something now?
Yeah.
Okay. So for double neutron stars, the globular rate is likely to be a small perturbation. But for black hole, because we don't, because we have such a paucity of observational information of such systems, we have to be open-minded to the possibility that dynamical effects could play a key role. Is that reasonable?
Yes, and the work, as far as I've seen it so far, dynamical work, like simulation, we're showing that actually merger rate of regular tetramer black holes to be high.
Yeah.
Would that be a good statement? Up to now, you're saying that it may not be true.
Yeah, look.
You can play the same game that you do for the neutron star mergers. You just extend it to tensor mass black holes.
Yeah.
You're saying it could be high relative to field.
Yes.
Higher
relative to field. I'm not saying higher.
Yeah.
There are big uncertainties in both, right? So you see different kinds of uncertainties. It's very hard to say. I mean, it's very hard to compare them. I mean, field versus.
No, but let's ask it in a different way. Are the globular clusters more efficient in making black hole binaries than they are making neutron star binaries?
Oh, yes.
In a relative sense.
Yes. That is true.
Even though the numbers of objects are smaller, you say that for these relaxation time arguments and things like that, they end up being more efficient.
The black holes, because there's a large mass gap between them and any other stars that exist after a billion years, they really sink to the center fast and produce dense subclusters. Neutron stars are close enough to the masses of other stars, it isn't as significant.
Also, if you have too many interactions, you typically keep the more massive components in them, so because you typically will need multiple interactions, it's not just a single sort of, you know, direct capture. Most of the time it's going to be few body interactions. The light guy frequently is the one that gets kicked out, so the pair that finally emerges is likely to be the pair that consists of two massive guys.
But then there's still the argument of time scales that this might happen too early in the universe, or relatively speaking to the 200 megaparsec volume.
Yeah, and so this is the key thing that Chris was mentioning, is that if there is, in fact, a rapid kicking out of the star mass black holes by themselves, then now we don't have a lot of options left. If it's possible to have tens still remaining in the current epoch, then you have better prospects for detectable. Well,
okay, but the issue here is that for binary stars forming these, you know, for just field stars,
yeah,
the fraction that are in binaries is pretty high.
Yes. Yeah, for massive stars, it's almost 100%, yeah.
So how many, you know, to really get a much higher efficiency, you're going to have to say, I'm going to get my tensor mass black hole to merge with 1,000, you know, well, I can get 10 times the efficiency by saying it merges with 10 and it 10 different stars in its lifetime.
Right. Well, also remember that for globulars, you are starting off with a huge handicap. which is that you only have 10 to the minus 4 of the stars and globulars that you do in galaxies.
Yeah, so, I mean, I would think that a globular cluster is more efficient per star than the galaxy, but it's you have the efficiency of being 10 to the 4 times less.
I guess here's the way I would phrase that. When you think about things like low-mass X-ray binaries, we know that per stellar mass, globulars are overwhelmingly more efficient than the field is. But the number of low-mass X-ray binaries is greater in the disk of the Milky Way than it is in the globular system. However, in the case of double black hole mergers, I think there's a slightly different circumstance. That is that within the uncertainties that we have, it could be that the rate in a disk of a galaxy like ours is really, really low. It might not be if you go to low metallicity, but you know, at this stage, we can't say for sure. There are dynamical channels in globulars that do not exist in the disk. So if it turns out that field formation in any circumstance is really rare for some reason, then you still have the option maybe of forming them in globulars because you have new ways of doing it. With neutron stars, the rate is high enough in the disks of galaxies or galaxies in general that even if you were ludicrously efficient, you probably know this argument. I think Stroll made it first. So the typical numbers you get for rate per Milky Way equivalent galaxy are 10 to the minus, few 10 to the minus 5 per year, right? If you were to take our globular system and have all 100 globulars each have 200 neutron stars that all come together in a Hubble time, that gives you a rate of 10 to the minus 6 per year. So even with absurd efficiency, you can't compete. But with black holes, we don't have the observations to give us the definitely high rate.
Do we need a discussion about this, or?
Well, I mean, one interesting question is how would you ever know where the?
There's one possibility actually.
From the point of view of the detection, I think what is interesting is that we expect that binary black holes from fields, we likely we have spin aligned. Instead of, you know, whatever direction?
I don't necessarily think that's true.
Well, because this is what we have been discussing here, and there was some consensus about that.
Taking the mass asymmetric mass ejection kicks, and assuming that, you know, heavy black holes don't get kicks, you would expect field populations to have very, very misaligned spins. That was my argument.
You expect
the No, I don't expect misaligned. I expect the spin to be aligned. If there's no kick for a black hole.
Well, and there's one more big caveat, which is that the supernova itself is not introduced. Forget about a velocity kick. It's not introduced a spin tilt.
That was just an assumption that was implicitly made that the spin direction is concerned.
Yeah, well, so what you know, if you assume that it just collapses down to a black hole and it's quiet, so it's not a supernova, then whatever the spin of the star is, and that also will not produce a kick if neutrinos aren't producing the kicks.
This argument is something that several people in the gravitational wave community are using to say that if we observe precession or not observe precession in binary black hole, could discriminate between coming from a globular cluster.
I don't think that's true.
I don't know whether we need some maybe discussion about this, or and maybe to know also how many events do we expect from globular clusters for binary black holes of 10, you know, solar mass objects.
Right. As I think my lower limits make clear, we can't determine the rates. Unfortunately, you can't really say what a minimum is. There are lots of ways you can measure.
Even for 10 solar mass objects?
That's a row of zeros there.
I'm talking about 10.
With 10 and 10, it's not zero, but if you pin me down to say, what is the absolute lower limit?
The
maximum? Well, if you're talking about a maximum, you're talking about 100 mergers per globular. But that's an absurd number, just like it would be for neutron stars.
So much larger than the one from the fields.
If everything is 100% efficient, and I really don't expect this, you imagine that of order of magnitude, you make 200 black holes in a 10 to the 5 solar mass globular, and they all merge with each other. So at that level, it's 100 per, and so it's 10 to the minus 6 per year for Milky Way equivalent galaxy, or 10 to the minus 8 per volume, per megaparsec cube per year. Maybe a factor of a few times that when you put in ellipticals. But that's not something you should say, this is a number that we're going to work with necessarily. At least it's a number you have as an upper limit.
No, I just want, I think my question is crazy, but I just want to understand, if you compare the prediction from fields and globular cluster, what are the numbers? Is this more likely to get
you back to the minus 5 and the minus 6?
But I was saying, there are two sets of numbers because they're all separate uncertainties where each one is uncertain by several orders of magnitude. I mean, they overlap.
No, because sometimes I hear people saying that we should not expect many events from globular cluster, that the one from fields are much higher. This is what I hear from astrophysicists.
Why? I mean, we don't know. I mean, I think there are two numbers with their own big systematic uncertainties, and the ranges, as we said, overlap. So Cole gave me a number that's roughly corresponds to one per year per Milky Way galaxy just now one per million years per Milky Way galaxy mergers of in globular clusters. That's about the number that Chris might predict for the field. So you know they're comparable potentially, but they could also be. It could be that one dominates the other by a factor of 100, because certainly each one, you know, one could be a factor of 10 smaller, one could be a factor of 10 larger.
But in terms of differences between the field and globular ones, I was going to say I do think that there's likely a difference. But it's not something where we're going to be able to say for an individual object, this is certainly from the globular or the field. I think it's masses. So I mentioned this, but maybe didn't elaborate as much as I should. Because of the nature that you have the heaviest two things winding up in the binary, if there's a lot of interaction, then you're going to go towards the heavy end of any distribution you're interacting with. So whereas suppose in the field, you end up with black holes that are typically 7 solar masses, which is one popular number now.
Actually 30 from one mass. You would probably see them from one mass environment.
Well, that's another thing. In globulars, as a low metallicity environment, it could be that you have even higher. But whatever it is, the interactions are going to tend to the higher mass portion of whatever distribution.
In the globular cluster.
That's right, because it's a dynamically dominated system that has many of these interactions. It's not that you have two black holes that have one interaction and then they go in. There are many interactions typically before they can finally merge. So this is likely to give you a bias towards higher masses. The spins, it determines on how well you think you understand the...
But before we go to spins, that's certainly true for the last binary, the last double black hole. However, as you know, we talk to people like John Frazier, people who actually do, let's say, binary-binary interactions, sometimes double black holes, binaries will be ejected from a cluster and they will stop interacting with the cluster. So they will actually form a global cluster black hole mergers that will not have a maximum mass. And there will be most of them, so you will have only one. I agree with you that you may form in the end that one very massive double black hole binary, but a lot of them will be kicked out in the meantime into the field.
You still have a lot of interactions before you get a tight enough binary that you can kick it out. So you're always going to have a lot of interactions. Now, whether a lot is enough to substitute in the most massive black holes is a quantitative issue to be done with simulations. But you're typically not going to start off with the original binary being so tight that it can kick it out.
So there is another caveat that you probably not take into account. Since you will be seeing volts from young massive clusters, they don't have that low metallicity. So I'm kind of postulating that actually low metallicity galaxies coming from high redshifts will have a similar mass to volts that you will form that way.
And you can't distinguish it.
Yeah, you cannot distinguish it.
That's the problem.
I still think that only spins will be able to do it.
Yeah, and I don't think spins will be able to do it. So
we have a discussion as well.
So this is an interesting situation. And basically it's because once the system, the spins of the black holes won't be reoriented by accretion during any phase, unless it's hyper accretion. And therefore you have to absolutely pin your hopes for spins on the formation not having any sort of misalignment. And I don't think we know enough to say that for sure.
You mean the formation of the binary?
No, the formation of the
field.
Black hole.
The black hole, yeah.
But that's something that you can test self-consistently with the well. It's potentially testable with the event rate, depending on if you like this in the park, is the strength of the kicks. It's also potentially correlatable with other observations that makes their binary.
Hey, look, if advanced LIGO detects a whole bunch of black hole mergers with aligned spins, that will tell us something. but as far as right now, I'm not sure that we can see.
If they're all aligned, then that tells
then it's
you.
Not dynamical.
It tells you. Yeah. If they're not aligned, then there's ways to make the field systems.
So I guess tomorrow we'll hear about how well we can measure the stands.
Okay.
Yeah, of course you can measure 1%.